morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Welcome to Democratic Perspective. Sitting across from me, Gary LeMaster.
A poor man's Mike Cousin,
taller than Mike is, and handsomer, I must say, Gary. And we have with us today a guest in the studio, Michael Lacey. Michael Lacey is a writer, editor, publisher. He founded the Phoenix New Times newspaper. Weekly in 1970. And I guess the iconic moment is there's a massacre at Kent State, which older people may still remember. Four students are shot, nine are wounded by the National Guard. They're not even near the National Guard when they're shot. And Michael and his crew decide to form a newspaper for some reason to deal with this. And they do. And what's amazing for if you go back into the 60s and 70s is how many of the newspapers have folded and faded away, and the Phoenix New Times survived and kept growing and is still in existence, still publishing, still taking on bad guys, I guess.
Yes, just recently, Steve Lemons has been writing about a crackpot that the Maricopa County attorney has hired to come into and train his staff of attorneys. And this guy is an Islamophobe. Wow. Everybody to him is a member of Hamas or the Muslim Brotherhood. In fact, this guy who's going to be training our prosecutors in Maricopa County believes that the current head of the CIA has become a Muslim, has converted, and is a secret infiltrator. That's how nutty this has become. So, yeah, the paper's still doing terrific work and doing lots of bringing you lots of news that you don't get anywhere else.
There's a whole industry of Islamophobes now out there. There's a fellow coming through here. There are these whole seminars and stuff. Anti-Muslim stuff seems to replace anti-Semitism as a way you can really travel around the country and make some fairly good sized bucks. And they seem to be able to convince people to hire them to do this kind of thing. Phoenix New Times, you sold it in 2012.
I believe that's correct, yes.
And at that time, Michael and his partner, Jim Larkin, you had the largest collective of alternative newspapers in the country, if maybe the only collection of.
We had as many at various points as 17 newspapers, and at the point that we sold it, I think we had 11, and that included the Village Voice in New York City and the LA Weekly, the Dallas Observer, the Houston Press, Miami New Times. It was successful. We were able to convert our idea and our approach into something that was financially viable.
And that was really rare, because the alternative I wrote for in Santa Barbara, I think, is long gone, disappeared decades ago.
Was that the Independent, Santa Barbara?
Yeah.
I remember the Independent.
Yeah. I don't even remember the name. You do.
But yeah. It was bought by the New York Times at one point. Okay.
Yeah. So there's this incident in at Kent State. You ask your group of friends, ask ASU to fly the flag at half mast. Four students are dead, unarmed, of course, and they refuse to do it.
Not only did they refuse to do it, but the governor insisted, this was Governor Jack Williams, that he would defend the integrity of the flag with whatever force was necessary. And there were, as you might imagine, a couple of thousand students. This was during the middle of the anti-war movement. The shootings at Kent State did not occur in a vacuum. And we asked the flag be lowered as a sign of respect to the dead. And there was a very smart head of campus security at the time, a former FBI agent named John Duffy. And John, of his own authority, lowered the flag to half mast, thereby dissipating the anger within the crowd. The demonstration broke up. But subsequent to that, we decided that we needed to chronicle what was going on. What was needed was a newspaper to communicate these events. There was a memorial demonstration that was planned subsequent to the shootings, and this became the focus of the very first issue of the newspaper, because as only can occur in a state like Arizona, the daily newspaper editorialized, urged construction workers to show up at Goodwin Stadium to show these kids what America was really all about. And the first story in the newspaper is a recounting of what happened at that memorial service, where the construction workers did in fact show up, and I was interviewing one of these construction workers because I was then a construction worker. And he said, "Excuse me, I'll be back in just a second." He got up from where we were sitting, walked out onto the field, and sucker punched and knocked out the teeth of the head of the anti-war movement in Arizona at the time, a guy named Joe Gerson, who was with the Tempe Peace Center. And Joe had made the mistake of having the American flag stitched onto his jeans upside down, the international sign of distress. The construction worker took offense, took action, and then returned to finish his interview with me.
Wow.
I remember those days very well. And very angry, a lot of very angry people. But in reality, I don't think it's any more angry than it is today in many ways. Yeah.
Well, I'm no longer surprised at passion, you know, or anger on both sides. And, you know, I didn't just work for construction. I came from a construction family. And so when I would go home in the summer to work construction, the dinner table was a very tense place.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And my home is, I grew up on a farm, and my dad was so angry. He was advised by my sister's boss to have me committed to a mental institution because I was against the war.
And how did that work out?
Not well. From anybody's point of view.
One of my proudest moments is the war had been going on for a long time, and my dad, walked into the den when I was visiting home one time, and he said, "Son, I thought you were a horse's ass when you opposed this war, but," he said, "you were right." And he said that in front of one of his friends who was a used car salesman. And I remember that moment, that affirmation of, you know, you were right, in front of one of his friends who, you know, and Archie was not exactly, you know, a reader of the New York Times or anything. I felt that was really strong. But yes, it split families in a way that I don't think people understand now. Maybe they do.
Well, I think it was very difficult for my father's generation, because he had been at Pearl Harbor and had fought through the Pacific campaign all through the war, and the idea that the armed forces, our armed forces, might be deployed in a way that they should not be, was really not something that was on his radar screen. His experience was entirely the opposite. You know, as someone who fought the Japanese throughout World War II, someone who, you know, was surrounded by the effects of fascism.
Michael Lacy's written dozens and dozens and dozens of articles, broken stories over the years in the New Time. I guess we have to jump to your arrest from founding the, and in 2004, you folks publish an article, and you're delving into Joe Arpaio's real estate holdings.
Right.
And you publish his address as his house, as well as all these properties he's trying to hide that he owns.
There's an obscure Arizona law that has never been invoked. It had not been invoked until we came along, that says quite reasonably that you're not supposed to publish the home address. And it was primarily aimed at judges because it was a right-wing movement in places like Idaho and Montana and other places where they were going after judges. Okay, so the idea was that you didn't want guys coming out of prison and clipping a judge. In Arizona, what we found was a really wonderful reporter, John Doherty, wrote some columns, some stories about Joe Arpaio's investments, real estate investments. And it was nearly, they were paid, he was able to find out that it was nearly $700,000 in cash that had been used to purchase these properties. And Arpaio invoked this law about your home address, you can secrete your home address to secrete his investments. Well, the lawmakers didn't write this with the intention or thinking that someone was going to come out of prison and go shoot your investment. Okay. Right. They were supposed to be protecting your home. So we published what we could and we said we can't get this information to find out more details about this. And by the way, he's not hiding his home address. His home address is available on the, it's listed on the web. It's listed on his nominating petitions. And we weren't trying to be wise guys. We just wrote as a matter of fact. Okay. Here's his home address on his, on the website. And here's his home address on the nominating petitions. And he had been, the sheriff's response was to wage, it was about a year and a half campaign to have us indicted, and county attorneys kept ducking it and kept refusing to do it, saying that they haven't done this. Okay, they haven't broken the law, and
it's a hard case when the law has been on the books for a long time. It's never been invoked, and right. You suddenly invoke it. It makes people suspicious of.
Well, and you also have to they have to demonstrate that you knowingly put this law enforcement person in danger, okay? And that was one of the stumbling blocks, okay? That was clearly not the case. But the county attorney, when there was a new election, and we got County Attorney Andrew Thomas, who was aligned with Sheriff Arpaio, and he appointed a special prosecutor named Dennis Willinchek. And Dennis Willinchek issued grand jury subpoenas. And there were a couple of things that were unique about that. I mean, first of all, they sought, these grand jury subpoenas sought to force us to identify who was reading our newspaper online. The prosecutor and the sheriff wanted to know who was reading critical articles of Joe Arpaio. Okay.
Astonishing.
And we of course, refused to.
And they wanted the people's IP address.
Yes, they wanted their IP address.
So they could arrest them.
So they could track down anybody who read, I mean, this is like, what would you call it, Gary? I mean, like, you know, that really tin pot dictator stuff.
Well, it was absurd. And it got worse because as, you know, we go into this grand jury proceeding, and a couple of things emerge out of this. Our attorney is a very smart guy, and in a grand jury subpoena, there is numerical identification paperwork that identifies it, and it's got to, the judge's got to sign off on it, and it's got the foreman of the grand jury's got to sign. Okay. Well, as it turned out, our attorney became suspicious of this, and it turned out these weren't legitimate grand jury subpoenas. The guy had just made them up. He issued them himself. There never was a grand jury that issued these subpoenas. This prosecutor just decided he was going to tell us there was a grand jury subpoena. Okay. And we ended up in front of a judge. Okay. So that's the first strange thing that's emerging from this. And then the second thing is we're sitting in this very secretive, you got to go through TSA-like security to make sure that I'm not bringing a revolver into the courtroom. And we're sitting there in this star chamber, and the judge emerges and starts screaming at the prosecutor, which is not normal judge-prosecutor interaction. Okay. And as I'm listening to this, what it turns out is that the prosecutor had attempted to arrange a secret meeting with the judge without us being present. And the intermediary who suggested that this occurred was a woman who had sat on the Judicial Commission for promotion. Okay, so this is someone who knows the players, who's got juice, okay, and who is trying to intercede to create what is called in the law an ex parte meeting. That means without us present. And as soon as I saw that, I decided we're going to write about this. Okay, we're going to, if I'm going to be hung, I'm going to be hung publicly. There's an old expression that with a grand jury, you can indict a ham sandwich. They allegedly had a grand jury. They had us in front of a judge, and they still weren't satisfied. They were trying to arrange a meeting, which, from our perspective, could only have been nefarious.
So, reducing the case, right.
So, at that point, I wrote a story about what had happened and what was transpiring. My partner, Jim Larkin, in a remarkably courageous move, put his name on the story with me. We ran it on the cover. And that night, the sheriff's deputies were pounding on my door and took me out in handcuffs and put me in jail. They also went to my partner's residence and took him out in handcuffs and led him out in an unmarked black SUV.
Astonishing. I remember, I've been here, I guess, since 2003 and visiting relatives many years before that. And I thought, I have never heard anything like the Joe Arpaio, Andrew Thomas, the way they used American law to punish political, opponents and critics. I had never seen anybody stoop quite that low and be quite that obvious, Michael.
Well, I think that, you know, what turns out in the end is that the county ended up giving away millions and millions of dollars to settle claims against the sheriff's office and against the county attorney. And what was unique about this is in many of these cases, I mean, we weren't the only ones. There were judges, there were politicians or elected officials. I mean, there was an entire string of people. I think there were 17 different individuals that received, in our case, we got $3.75 million. We were the largest beneficiary of this. But in so many instances, no one got compensated for the kinds of outrageous behavior. My oldest son was home from college, and I said, "Well, you're not going to sit around. You're going to come with me in a few things." And I took him out to Guadalupe, Arizona, which is primarily a Yaqui Indian and Mexican community that's contiguous with Phoenix.
It has extremely good Mexican food.
It's really good Mexican food as a byproduct. Okay, and this was when Arpaio he had been converted. He initially had said that it wasn't his job to go after gardeners when it came to migrants, but when he saw how popular it was with Andrew Thomas, he then made a campaign of going after migrants, and he took over the town of Guadalupe, set up that big command vehicle that he has got, and had unmarked cars racing up and down the streets, lights flashing, pulling people with brown skin over. Okay, this was probably the most important civics lesson that my son ever had, was to see what happens when it goes wrong.
Yeah.
By my calculations, just as a casual observer, not living in Maricopa, I think there's about 11 million now, maybe much more than that, that has been paid out by the county for Arpaio's excesses, not to mention the profit that he makes from his tent city. It's just astounding to me that somebody like that can continue to get elected.
Well, he keeps getting elected by smaller margins, but the and you know, he has historically run against people that did not have a very high profile, good men but low profile, and you know, when I don't know what happens here in the future, but the The voters have not held him accountable, and it may be because they like what he's been doing. But more to the point, the county board of supervisors have not held him responsible, have not held him financially responsible, fiscally responsible, have not audited his books, have not done the sorts of things that would have brought him into accountability. The Goldwater Institute, which is, this is not some left-wing fantasy outfit. They follow the principles of the man they're named after. They
not,
did
not exactly. They're far more conservative than he was.
Well, but the point is they're very conservative.
Right.
Okay, and they did an investigation, and they're the ones that really sort of documented and wrote about, as did the East Valley Tribune, about all these unprosecuted warrants that were out there, including an unforgivable amount of child molestation and abuse that the sheriff's office hadn't been investigating while they were rounding up Mexican gardeners.
Yeah. We talked to one of the investigative reporters at one of the news stations and papers down in Phoenix, and he said, you know, if we've told people what he's doing. We told them there were 6,000 cases, Gary, mm-hmm. of unprosecuted child molestation type of cases, child abuse cases. And he said, we've told the public of that. And if they haven't done anything about it, it's on the Arizona public now. The word is out about the sheriff.
Well, that was a point I was going to make. You said that maybe the people of Maricopa actually like what he's doing. And I think that's really disturbing to think that a majority of voters in the county would think that using the law to bully people and to go after racially profile people is pretty disturbing. If that is true, that the voters actually like that behavior, it says a lot about the county and about the state.
Well, I think that's absolutely the case. And the race baiting and roundups and sweeps have been the story in Phoenix, and it took the Arizona Civil Liberties Union suing Sheriff Joe Arpaio to stop these, roadblocks where they were rounding up brown people, mm-hmm. asking, are your papers in order? I mean, we haven't had that since Germany in the 30s.
Astonishing. So what are you doing? What are you and your partner doing with the $3.75 million going to buy a new car or?
That's something like that. We've started something called the Lacey and Larkin Frontera Fund, okay, the border fund. And what we were doing with the money is that we're going around Arizona and we're giving out grants to groups that work with migrants, to try to help migrants, or groups that work with the Latin American community. There's an organization in Phoenix, for example, that brings the police department together with Latin American communities, not necessarily migrants, but just any place where Latin Americans, Mexicans live here in Phoenix, and tries to make sure that we don't have a Ferguson, Missouri, here in Phoenix, Arizona. There's an organization in Tucson that we've given money to called No More Deaths. Okay, and there are a couple of groups in Tucson that go out in the desert, set up water stations, and try to aid migrants as they're coming across. There's a woman down there at the University of Arizona named Robin Renicki who is doing a remarkable thing. She is working with the coroner's office, identifying remains, and then trying to get in touch with the families in Mexico to let them know what happened to their loved ones, because we're still losing a couple hundred people a year in the desert, in the Arizona desert, and talk about a forgotten population. So that's what we're doing with the money right now, and the karma of us being able to take money from a guy who has persecuted Mexicans and give it to Mexican groups that are trying to help help these migrants. That keeps you occupied.
I love it. It's too many people would have taken the money and gone and bought a couple of Veyrons or.
So. What's your proudest moment? I mean, you've written, and I was looking on the internet, you've written, I guess, hundreds of stories over the years and published hundreds of stories. What is your proudest moment when you took on the Sheriff Joe Arpaio, or is there something else? He has a really good article back in 1990 about a fellow who was sentenced to, 50 years in prison for selling one rock of cocaine worth about $20. You're one of the first people to raise the disparity between crack and cocaine sentencing in the country, I think, with something like pointing that out.
Well, it isn't any one particular story. What I'm proud of is that I took an initial instinct, which was a problem with authority, okay, and managed to channel that into something that was both creative and long-lasting, and that was built upon the talent of young writers and young salespeople. Our organization was composed of young people, and there's a competition in America called the Livingston Awards, and it's for young journalists. Okay, and we had more winners and finalists in that competition over the period that we operated the organization than any news organization in the country. Okay, we won a Pulitzer. We created, it used to be that the New York Times had a very famous food critic. But really, that was about the level of what food criticism was. And our organization said, no, food and restaurants and going out and that kind of social environment is important. And we then began to dominate restaurant criticism. We had young salespeople that, instead of running away from controversial stories, embraced them and took them out into the business community and said, look, there is a readership for this and you need to support this financially. And they persuaded business people to do just that. So, what I'm proud of is that Jim and I we sold the paper back to the senior management team. And they continue to publish great stories, and they continue to convince advertisers to come with us.
And you're happy to what happened to this, actually, to call it an empire, that all these newspapers after you left, after you gave, it must have been hard to let go after, because you guys had run the thing for so long, for decades.
Well, I do think it is difficult to let go. But believe me, the people that we worked with were happy to have us let go.
Talk a little bit about alternative newspapers. I used to travel a good deal from large city to large city, and I always felt personally that if I really wanted to know what the city was about, I would pick up one of the alternative newspapers. They're free, and I could find great reviews on restaurants and theater but there was always a risk taking that you didn't see in the mainstream newspapers. What do you think that is?
I think that mainstream journalism got overwhelmed with the 5 W's in the inverted pyramid, which was a very formulaic way of approaching a story, and objectivity. Okay, and there's a balance there, because at the same time that when we started, there were a lot of alternative newspapers that were just like running opinions. It was like essays and editorials and screeds from one end to the other. And we always said to the writers, You've got to go out and report the hell out of this before you sit down to write, because no one is interested in your opinion. Your readers are as smart as you are. They have opinions, and this sort of foreshadowed what happened with the explosion of the internet, where there is a tsunami of opinion, and barely ripples of reporting. And so we tried to change that. Now, that's not to say that daily newspapers aren't doing a terrific job in, even the Arizona Republic, which had been, our competition for years here in Phoenix. When you read Bob Ortega on the border, he's doing really wonderful work. There's a woman there, is it Megan Cassidy, maybe? She's also done great stuff. One of our former writers, Michael Kiefer, is a terrific reporter for them. So I think readers, consumers of news, are better served now than they've ever been. But they have to be more selective about what they're looking at because of the explosion of media content. But there really, literally, today is something for everyone.
I think the other thing people don't realize, is how difficult investigative reporting is. We talked to the fellow who broke the story on one of the big Eastern stories, and what he said, he worked on the story for 2 years. 2 years, the Washington Post invested in his investigatory journalism, and if the principal hadn't made a mistake and done a filing in Delaware, they never would have put the whole story together. What the impression we got is it takes a tremendous amount of effort and time to put a lot of these stories together.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And if it used to be in daily journalism that reporters had to crank out a certain number of stories per week, okay, and our reporters, by contrast, were taking, 3 weeks or longer to do a cover story. And there's a critical balance that has to be struck by management in terms of what the expectation is with reporters. And, and the pressure's gotten worse. Our writers are now not just doing the cover stories, but they're also posting blogs. And it's a very labor-intensive business, but it is the work that yields the result. And it's hard work, lots of work.
A lot of the New Times has focused over the years on political corruption, economic corruption. A lot of this stuff is very, very hard to trace, right?
Yes.
You can see the evidence, but you can't put it all together a lot of times, I think, is the problem.
Well, you've got basically two sources. One is the record, okay, the financial trail, paper trail, that sort of thing. And the other is the human conversation that goes on. And I think all good reporters are particularly adept at getting people to trust them and buy into the idea that they should have a conversation about what's been going on. Janet Malcolm, who's just a terrific writer, once wrote that if writers were honest with themselves, they would admit that what they are doing is persuading people to reveal those things that should never be uttered publicly. And I think there's a real truth in that. There's a certain level of revelation that occurs late night in a bar, okay, for example. That's very useful, that augments what you're finding in public files.
Right, and the paper trail can be very, very difficult to follow. We had we went to a seminar, and the ability to hide stuff, to dump tons and tons of documents on the public that are all sort of uncataloged, a lot of times they're not in electronic form, can just overwhelm an investigation if it's not very carefully focused.
With the websites like opensecrets.org that provide a lot of this information, I write a blog and I use those kinds of resources to dig through, And it's really time consuming even to dig through, you know, websites and reports to ferret out the information you want and then put it in a context. It's a very, to do it without that prior to things like Open Secrets would have been a nightmare.
Well, there's, you know, the Melendrez case, which is the case ACLU brought against Sheriff Arpaio for racial profiling, is, you know, a good example, the in terms of the kinds of investigation, and this is a court investigation, by the way, okay, this isn't just some journalist. The sheriff was ordered to produce all of these records, and instead the sheriff destroyed the records. And it was only the fact that the county maintained a separate duplicate of this that allowed all of this information to emerge in public. Now, at this point, not only is the judge, a remarkable man named Murray Snow, personally overseeing what's been revealed, okay, and the reforms that have been requested, but more recently there was a deputy who committed suicide, okay, and there is the suggestion that the deputies were shaking down migrants, okay, for money, and the court and the sheriff has produced, and the court has ordered, there are 500 hours of videotape of various stops that have to be reviewed right now, and even with the evidence being available, going through 500 hours of videotape and trying to, you know, crush that and make sense of what's there, it's an exhaustive level of research.
That deputy, I think you were, you know, alluded to, had a house full of records that had not been kept at the sheriff's office and had not been filed. More recently, there's another one of Arpaio's deputies that has stepped forward and written a book about the sheriff's office. He was one of the top deputies.
Is it Brian Sands?
I forget the name.
Yeah.
It sounds right, but he has written a book about Arpaio's excesses, and so the heat is turning up on the sheriff's seat. But it's still astounding to me that there isn't an outcry for his resignation.
Well, I don't think that there will ever be that outcry for his resignation, nor would he listen.
I'm sure he would listen
to those voices. I'm persuaded that the sheriff will die in office.
My younger days, I did lien searches in New York City, which has just been around for a very, very long time, and it was hard just to find out who owned what. I spent hours and hours in these musty, these hand-scripted books, everything written in from the 18-something or others, trying to find out if there was a lien against somebody's wine cellar. I mean, just that simple kind of thing took hours. And, of course, we were getting paid for it to do it. But a lot of the data, folks, is now being copied into and made electronic, which should make these things easier than the, in my day, you had to physically go to the particular courthouse where the documents were taken, and that would lead you to another courthouse. And I mean, but now things have gotten easier. Where do you think people should look for news stories in Arizona? And I understand you've got some book proposals out. Are they?
Well, my book proposals are not about the work that I've done, because if there's one thing that I'm not interested in, it's me. And so doing a book or doing more research on me would put me to sleep. But I think, as I mentioned earlier, I think there's a rich variety of sources to look at these days. And in Arizona, there are good writers at the daily newspapers. In Arizona, you've got Monica Alonso and Ray Stern and Stephen Lemons. I mean, you've got people writing at New Times that are doing terrific stories. And they're able to go in, for example, you know, Monica Alonso just did a terrific piece on Grant Woods, the former attorney general, who is a college roommate of the current candidate for governor, and who is the guy that was hired to look at the Fiesta Bowl corruption and gave it a pass and said there was nothing wrong here, okay? Subsequent to that, we find out that one of the executives goes to jail over what was going on with the Fiesta Bowl. You think that you know what there is to know about the professor at the University of Arizona who was fired when she was doing pot research, marijuana research, as it applied to veterans, post-traumatic stress, okay? If you read Ray Stern's story, you begin to understand that you don't know all that there was involved with that. The same thing with Stephen Lemons on the county attorney hiring a Muslim phobe, Islamic phobe, to come in here. So, you know, you need to be curious. As a reader, you need to be as curious as our writers are. Okay, and that's where you'll develop your list in terms of what you're looking at on the internet and what you can trust. And I don't rule out anybody.
What do you look for in a writer for the New Times? I know that you're retired from the newspaper now, but you still write articles. What did you look for in writers?
I think the most valuable asset was curiosity. You know, and unwillingness to accept at first blush that which you were being told. It is, we had a gentleman, Andy Vandevoort, who lived in Denver, and his job was to travel around the country and go to the various journalism schools all over America and try to identify young writers that we could bring into the organization. So, and I think that what he found was curiosity. And the fact that my partner and I are college dropouts means that we don't necessarily need to find someone that's been certified. We're open to the proposition that people bring skills.
Yeah, and the Phoenix New Times was never the New York Times, the gray lady used to call it. And it's straightforward, sort of hard-hitting, blunt, right?
Yes.
The writing is blunt and straightforward and pulls no punches at all. It's and it's willing to take on, the paper's been willing to take on pretty much anybody who you guys thought needed taking on.
It's a wonderful way for malcontents to make a living.
Now, that is a marvelous thing, right, Gary?
Yes, I think one of the other factors is, you know, along with the curiosity, is I find this so often on the internet and in the media, is that you look at a story, whether it matches your opinion or somebody else's, or it's against it, and it often just doesn't smell right. And I think you have to have the intuition to say, I'm going to look deeper into that.
Yes. And, you know, the other thing that we haven't mentioned is that when you're not using a formula for writing and when you're writing at length, like magazine length stories, okay, you have to be able to write. I mean, and many people can't. For example, it appears to that in law school they beat that out of you. If you've read as many legal briefs as I've read, okay, you just wonder, whoa, this is really ESL.
And this is
really English as a second language.
And lawyers always think they're great writers.
Yeah, and academia too. There's a style sheet, and you have to stick to the style sheet.
Before we run out of time, I want to do a plug from our sponsors. The Door is having a breakfast on this last Thursday at 8 a.m. at the Old Sedona Family Restaurant Bar and Grill. And our guests are going to be the new mayor of Sedona and the new city council members. Should be interesting if you're interested in Sedona politics.
And also Scott Jablow and Rio Robeson, who are running for the remaining place on the council. So it should be, this will be a free-floating discussion. People ask, why do we ask people to write out cards? It's because we don't want speeches from the floor. But this is going to be a free-floating discussion. You'll be able to talk to people who are already elected about what their plans are. Join us next week. We're going to have an interview with Terry Goddard, who's running for Secretary of State. He's the former Attorney General of Arizona. Thank you very much for joining us. Thank you, Michael, for coming in.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.